You are listening to the Radical Tea Party here on Enemy Combatant Radio, streaming to you live from the Mission, syndicated on Radio X in Seattle and San Francisco Liberation Radio, 93.7 FM on your dial. We're here with you every Wednesday from 4 to 6 p.m. And we have a great, great show lined up for you guys today. I'm very excited. We have Dr. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz in the studio for a conversation today, and we're going to be talking about many, many different things. So stay tuned, and if you have questions for our esteemed guest or comments or whatnot, feel free to call in. The number here to the studio is 415-864-1006. All right, we'll be back, right back in a second. This is Bikini Kill. Keep it here. We're back. This is the Radical Tea Party. Here with you every Wednesday from 4 to 6 p.m. And in the studio, I would like our guest to introduce herself, and maybe some of you will recognize her from different speeches and events that you've probably attended, not only in the Bay Area but elsewhere, and possibly from the O'Reilly Factor as well.
You remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and I've had a nice interview before with Sunny, and it's like continuing our conversation, probably repeating myself.
Nah.
But I am a writer, and the two books I've written and the one I'm working on now are autobiographical memoir, not memoirs. I am old enough to write memoirs, but I'm not famous enough to, but there's a whole genre of writing.
But is that important, though? Like, well, shouldn't every...
Yeah, well, the anyone of any age should be writing their own experiences. Activists, in particular, need to be immediately communicating their activist experiences directly. I think one of the big mistakes we made in the 1960s, that in fact the women's liberation movement that I helped start tried to change, was the sense of being objective observers, you know, being kind of outside of the experience, sort of like instruments of change rather than subjects of change. And it was it sort of dehumanized our movement. And I think the movement now is far more humanized and universalized, because it also cares about the earth itself and all living things and animals, and not just human-centric. But it's important to write and speak about the experience and not feel like you're an egomaniac. And that was very hard for me, because I have a doctorate in history, and it's hammered into us in graduate school. The biggest no-no is to ever bring yourself into the story, because this makes it unobjective.
Oh, come on.
And or to even express your opinion. So what you have is history written under the guise of being objective, which is really just hiding the fact that it is a human being writing it. And if you don't know where they stand on something, where they're coming from, what their political views are, you can be greatly misled by how they're interpreting the so-called facts. And postmodernism has changed that a lot, so that, you know, there's a kind of demand now that you reveal who you are, your stance in relation to the material that you're investigating, whether it's science or the arts or politics or anything else. But journalism is still under the pretense of being objective, you know, observers.
Indie media does not claim to be objective.
No, that's, of course not.
We're the first ones to tell the truth.
Right.
There is no objectivity.
And to let people know, you know, that it's critical thinking, that here's where we stand, and we want you to think it through and come to your own conclusion, rather than trying to foist off on people opinions as if they're facts that they have no right to question. And that's very much what journalism does. Mainstream journalism.
I was going to ask you, is it, you know, can anyone write, like earlier I said, you know, can anyone write a memoir? And that kind of is like a loaded question, because, you know, like, is it okay just for anyone? Like, do you have to be a certain class? Or in some ways it's like, should we not have, you know, anyone from an upper class? Because we don't really care what they think about, you know, theory or history or anything, you know, I mean...
Well, I think activists who come from privileged backgrounds, that it's very important for them to reveal, rather than sort of being embarrassed or hiding behind that, to reveal the step-by-step kind of what I would consider liberation, you know, from their class, and how that happens. Because I think others from that class, the sort of... might say class traitors, like we talk about race traitors, you know, we or I would say male traitors, sex traitors too, where you give up the privileges of that class and ask others to do so. So we have the myth of not having class in the United States, and now we have this Proposition 54 that's trying to say we don't even have race, you know, in this country.
Right.
And it completely twists the struggle for justice and equality to pretend as if there's already a level playing field and equality. Everyone is born equal, and we're not. So I think the more that privileged people, whether it's males or whites or upper class people, Or upper-class women, let's say, or upper-class minorities, reveal their situation and explain it, the more powerful our movement will be, because we don't need a bunch of people feeling guilty and hiding behind things. I think people burn out doing that. They mm-hmm. give up. They get depressed because anyone who's living a lie is not an energetic and happy person. And so I think the memoir is I only started doing it, working with it, about 14 years ago, when I was trying to experiment with new, it was a little longer than that, it was about 20 years ago, experimenting with new ways to write history. And I kind of tried the Howard Zinn way of, you uh-huh. know, just making it more readable and more interesting narratives and stories about other people. But
we're just telling it like one way, you know.
Yeah.
Like instead of well, half of the slaves weren't whipped. It's like, well, half of them were. You
right.
know, like rephrasing
yeah, yeah.
it.
Rephrasing it. But even I don't really like very much to read Howard Zinn's history. I mean, I'm glad it's there and I use it in my classes, but I keep wanting to know about Howard Zinn. You know, tell me about yourself too. You know, tell me who you are. And I still find it, you know, a narrative about someone else. And not that you have to in my books, my memoirs I've written, they're really a trying to reconfigure history and facts, things that were happening, say, in my childhood, that I wasn't really aware of, but I came to know about later, contextualizing those things, because they do have an effect mm-hmm. on you, even if you're not aware that you're aware of them at the time. So the whole McCarthy era, I was, you asked about my background, I was, my father was a sharecropper. We were in rural poverty, extremely poor. My mother, part Indian, we were very isolated in rural Oklahoma, where there was a kind of police state mentality, because it had been very radical in the past, and clamped down on. My own grandfather had been in the industrial workers of the world. And I heard those stories from my father. So in Red Dirt, I tell my grandfather's stories. But in the McCarthy era in the 1950s, in that witch hunting era, these were kind of whispered stories, because it wasn't safe. It was actually illegal to even own a whole list of books that were banned by the state of Oklahoma, like anything by Marx, but also anything by Jack London or anyone who was ever a socialist. W.B. Du Bois, I never heard of him until I came to California. And yet, I know, you know, I've learned since then about the McCarthy era, and I realize it was affecting people there, even though I didn't, you know, I didn't know mm-hmm. anything about it. I didn't know about right. That much about it, except little pieces of it. So we didn't have the kind of communications then that we have now. But even now, I think people in the United States, in this highly technological society, that most people are not dealing with the news with the new technology. They're dealing more with entertainment, or they watch right. Fox News and get...
Well, politics is entertainment, you know.
Yeah.
Schwarzenegger doesn't need to announce his candidacy on
right.
anything but the Tonight Show.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's like, that's where people today get their political information. Is
so. That's why I think that we have to bring back the oral tradition and write it down too. But tell our stories,
right.
tell them over and over, these stories. And I realized that was the great gift I had from my own impoverished and really not very pleasant childhood. Poverty is not something I romanticize. It's damned hard. There's a lot of violence that goes with it. My mother became an alcoholic. People are turn on each other, and it's very harsh. But the one great gift I had was my mother and father were both storytellers. My mother was very ashamed of her Indian background. So she told kind of fantasy stories, but my father told the stories of his father, who was a wobbly, and these stories stayed with me, and I think are really the kernel of why and how I came to find, a radical stance in this society, because everything was against it, and my older
right.
brothers and sisters didn't, And well, he never told part them of the stories.
But that you're right. I mean, that's part of it. Well, what an oral tradition does.
Exactly.
Is, you know, it's not just relating facts. By relating those facts, you're able to, you know, try and understand why things happened,
right,
and come to grips with some pretty difficult issues.
It gives you an infrastructure for understanding the world.
Right.
And I really learned that and came to value that when I was involved in the American Indian Movement and also married to a Pueblo Indian storyteller and poet who was trying to revive that. I mean, many Indians lost that too, but many kept, or some kept it and kept it going and telling a few people. So he was one of the people who had received Simon Ortiz. His writings are just wonderful to read. I highly recommend them, poetry and stories and essays. He, in the 70s, he really encouraged me to write my stories. But like I say, I was a new PhD in history. And no, I'll write other people's stories,
mm-hmm,
but not mine.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and you have, you know, we're talking about oral history, and you have such a absolutely fascinating history, you know, spanning, you know, running the gamut from every possible hat that a woman can wear, I think, and even some that women would never think to wear. And I'd really like you to talk about that, about, you know, the different roles that you've played throughout your life and how, you know, and looking back on them, how, you know, you maybe wouldn't choose to do those things again, or maybe you would, or, you know, how those things kind of influenced each other. Particularly, you know, the differences between being a bride and then, you know, like an armed revolutionary, or,
right,
you know, being a professor, or, you know, being an activist. I mean,
yeah,
what are...
Well, you know, my first book, Red Dirt, which just went up to 1960 when I moved to California, is very much about my childhood in Oklahoma and the history. I try to take the history back to my grandfather's world. So, like, the first half of the 20th century, I wanted it to be a kind of kernel, you know, or contain the history of the United States within, and going back beyond that, of the settler class. My father comes from the Scots-Irish settler class, my mother part Indian, so a kind of microcosm. Now, then Outlaw Woman, which picks up in 1960 and goes to 1975, is how I became a political activist and at least desiring to become a revolutionary. I'm not sure I can really call myself that. In fact, I call the book Outlaw Woman. I don't call it Revolutionary Woman or even Warrior Woman, because I'm not sure I ever got beyond the outlaw stage of my political consciousness during
that. So what's the difference
time
between the two? What would you say?
Well, I would say, you know, the outlaw is a familiar character in the formation of the United States. And I think it's probably why it's our strongest tendency toward radicalism and resistance to domination and authority. It's kind of an anarchist tradition. And I think it may be why we haven't been very successful in dismantling the United States or mm-hmm, turning it into, let's say, a Canada.
Canada.
Instead of what it has become. And a predator. I don't say the outlaws cause that. I say the outlaw, it's a limited effect. And I think that, you know, the story I try to tell in Outlaw Woman is not so much one of regrets, though it was very hard to write, because at the same time, I don't want to apologize for anything anyone did during that time to oppose racism, imperialism, the war in Vietnam, the interventions in South mm-hmm America and Chile. The anniversary's coming up soon, the 30-year
yes
anniversary of the coup in Chile.
Which probably won't get any coverage because of the...
Yeah, because of 9/11, right, the other 9/11. And I think that we never really were able to detach ourselves during that time or since, you know, and I do think it's what we have to do, to detach ourselves from the probably what's a very human quest for a sense of community that we call nationalism, you know, the so-called American community, that we have to build, and I think we have, and there have been utopian communities. Our tendency is either to fight that power, to change it, to overthrow it. This was what I was a part of, simply overthrow it and take power.
Right.
Another tendency is utopianism, where people form little, didn't just start with the communes in the 60s, back in the 19th and even 18th century, there were all these religious and some of them not religious utopian communities like the Amana people and the Shakers and the Quakers and the Mormons, and they go off and, you know, form their little communities, and something has to happen. Either they disband or they become predators themselves, like the Mormons, you know, owning Lucky Foods and, you know, big corporations and everything, or Amana that they invented the, you know, washing machine, the microwave and everything, became a very wealthy community. Or the Shakers, who invented the furniture. So they become, you know, really, maybe they retain their identity as such, but they become assimilated into the
American economy. Is that a survival skill in some ways? You know,
it's sort of like what you see in Israel, the kibbutzim, who they're very utopian communities, many of them socialists, that become frontiers for, you know, expansion of the borders of Israel. And I think there are a lot of similarities there, that Israel's a kind of, in a way, a miniature of the United States. And when people criticize Israel and look at it, what it's doing, they should really reflect on that and see that it's pretty much the same pattern as how the United States was formed and expanded. Right. It, of course, it will never be as universally oppressive as the United States has become, but it is regionally. So these are very unusual. These are covenant nations. You know, the South Africa, the apartheid regime was a covenant. These are chosen people ideas, and I think as movement, we have to be really lucidly aware of those cultural tendencies and the heroic mode, you know, of the great outsider like Schwarzenegger or Bush or Reagan will come in and save everyone, you know, like Superman or the
Bush? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think people didn't see him that way, but after 9/11, it's sort of they treated him, you know, as because I think people, it's kind of built into us that we want someone to take charge,
right?
You know, and it's a kind
after 9/11, his ratings went. You know, people were making fun of him for, you know, pronouncing things wrong.
Right.
You know, weeks before, and then all of a sudden he was.
Yeah, one of the great criticisms in the early 60s by some social critics, William Lederer and Eugene Burdick. I think they wrote a book called Nation of Sheep, among other things, like Fail Safe and, you know, those wonderful social critic novels. But A Nation and The Ugly American, that for all of our vaunted individuality, that there is a strong tendency to follow a savior, a leader, you know, to get out of things rather than taking responsibility, community responsibility.
You know, and you're talking about, you know, a force kind of coming from the outside and forcing people to assimilate, whether, you know, because they have more power. And so people, as a survival tactic, they have to do that. I'm really interested also in your critique, especially in Red Dirt Woman. You know, you attempt to answer some of these questions that still, I think, I know many women that I talk with still today that talk about these inside forces, the forces within inside our own groups, the forces particularly that are male dominated, you know, and as a feminist, as an activist involved in you know, several radical groups, it's amazing to me that
you know, with all the struggle that's going on outside of these groups, we still have to deal with so much bullshit within these fighting groups. It's horrible.
Yeah, I think if we took for, you know, several things for granted, that they are forever, because at least for a long, long time, that these things, you know, as human beings, we may be millions of years old as a species, but as, say, people who lived in groups and made communities, this is only like 1% of our total time of existence on Earth, you know, the last 50,000 years. And it took that long to build up these patterns. I don't think they're biological. I think they're patterns that come out of really harsh life, you know, hunting. And people, I think that people created societies that were really societies based on human needs that accommodated. Mm-hmm. I know of several. One, you know, the pre-colonial Pueblo societies in New Mexico, for instance, really worked on it. They worked on if there was a tendency for men. I mean, they have more muscle. They're slightly larger. They have an instrument that sticks out that can, you know, if it's obsessed upon, could become a symbol for power, you know, the penis power. Mm-hmm. But they really acknowledged that and then worked at trying to level the playing field, you know, through ritual.
It's very balanced.
And to balance things, but they had to work at it all the time. And after the colonialists came in, the missionaries, and started forcing people to change, you know, the Catholic Church, it was Spanish colonization, you saw them lose a lot of these. So now you see big gaps in the ability to, you know, create that balance, and also just not having economic self-sufficiency and so forth. So these things aren't forever, and racism has, you know, there are different estimates. I think the kind of racism we have now is only 500 or 600 years old, but obviously there were other things that led to it. Maybe the gender segregation that mm-hmm. formed before that time led to the possibilities of racism. Then we have economic superiority instead of potluck to balance the, you know, the goods so that no mm-hmm. one is richer than anyone else and no one has power over anyone else. We now have a worship of wealth and power, you know, worship of those individuals who have power. The thing I hear most said about Schwarzenegger is, oh, well, he's really a completely neutral person who would not be beholden to special interests because he's wealthy. And it makes no sense at all. I mean, he's wealthy, so he's going to work in the interests of wealthy people.
Absolutely.
I mean, what is he, God come to earth, you know? I mean, the man is a materialistic.
He's very concerned,
wealthy.
This is a quote, he's very concerned that the Californians are being taxed from the moment they wake up and flush their toilets.
Right.
He's very concerned.
Of course,
he says, this is crazy, and, you know, and it's just like, oh, wow, you are just.
So, it, you know, this worship of wealth and all of that. I don't think there's anything biological, but I do think we have, as human beings, we have big brains and we have a lot of, you know, of mastery, possibilities for mastery. And anything that's powerful can be misused. And
absolutely.
Unless we're super conscious and dealing with it all the time.
So
I don't think
how do you deal with that? Because like you said, you know, many people, I think it's kind of a cop-out to say, well, this is biological, because that you know, makes some assumption that it can't be changed, that your behavioral patterns can't be changed. But at the same time, you know, you were saying, well, I think it's cultural, but at the same time, you gave some examples of particularly Native American communities, and I can also think of some, you know, like the Cherokee, the Chippewa, and the Chickasaw mm-hmm. that used to be very kind of matriarchal and very dependent upon women.
Right.
Is as advisors to, and they would pick who got to sit on the council.
Right.
And if they didn't like someone, they would take them off. But nowadays, you know, I hear arguments like that. Well, I grew up with a hard life, you know, and so therefore I get to yell at meetings, you know. Right. My parents yelled at me when I was young, and so I'm going to dominate right. this activist meeting, and I'm going to yell, and it's like, how do you deal with stuff like that?
You know, the understanding that we began to come to out of the 60s, and I think it is a major contribution that we made at that time, and especially the civil rights movement was bringing to consciousness what oppression is, how it works, and that can easily get turned around to a power, you know, a weapon, a tool of power itself, to wield power rather than to really create harmony. And I think the person who does that is no more responsible than, say, the group that allows it to happen, you know, to let that person wield the power, because they couldn't do it unless everyone said, yes, you've been oppressed, therefore I give up my power to you.
Right, right.
No one should ever do that, give up their own sense of dignity and
it's also really amazing to me how many, like the other half of the men within many of these groups are typically the first ones to become very quiet and be like, yeah. Okay, this isn't happening. That guy isn't acting out like that. He's right. not being an asshole. I'm not noticing this. Okay. Whereas women, I think, are, yes, it's very difficult for them to speak out about things. And, you know, they typically know that when they do speak out, they're going to get targeted because right. of it. But yet they at least do it. You know, they at least make an effort, varying levels of you know, assertiveness, but they make an effort to point it out. But many other men just are like, you know what, I can't let myself, you know, I can't let this guy know that I feel this way, and I can't stand up to him. And it's just very, I don't understand.
It's hard, but I think, I don't know, as groups form, you know, I've been through many group formations, past and present, where, you know, you start out with a project, whatever it is. Let's say war times that started 2 years ago, right after 9/11. I was involved in some of the early meetings. I won't be critical of it because I think it's an important instrument, but it was the last thing I was part of that where I saw it, you know, in the formation stage. And I have to fault myself, although I made, you know, some attempts. I think everyone felt very raw at that time. Like, what we needed more than anything was unity and getting ourselves together. How are we going to react to this? And how are we going to prevent a war in Afghanistan? And, you know, which was already on the agenda. And I don't think we were even suspecting Iraq yet. So I'm not faulting. I'm just, you know, and looking back, I can see what I could have done, what could have been done, what others could have done, is from that kernel to make sure that the question of gender, I think race was pretty well considered because it was mainly third world people who started, including women. But gender, I felt, was an issue that wasn't, and it was so important because here's Bush using the question of women and liberating the women of Afghanistan.
Oh, and Iraq.
And I felt like, you know, that wasn't something that we could have, I don't mean opportunistically, but by necessity, and because we always should look at what's happening to the women. In this case, it was so obvious, but if you follow war times, really there's not much, or what is there is kind of rhetorical. And I think women have kind of fallen away to the fundraising and so forth, and the people who go around speaking about it are the men. And so just in that experience, I've thought, and I don't think, I think I did speak up. I finally kind of dropped out because I felt like this wasn't something I wanted to put. I was writing, you know, I was finishing my Outlaw Woman. The best thing I could do is just keep my nose to the grindstone, finish the project I was doing. But I look back and I think how I could have at least met with some of the women, you know, talked about a women's caucus, talked about women's leadership, you know, whatever. But I think if we can be conscious of that when we first start something, build into it the question of race, class, and gender.
Right.
As and be
do,
sure,
do they all have equal footing with each other?
I think they do. Okay. I mean, they're very different. You know, each one's very different. But I don't like to sort of create a triage of which is most important, or because I have race, class, and gender issues that I'm several notches above someone else in oppression.
I'm more oppressed than you are. I'm more radical than you are.
But I think, kind of a numbering system. How many?
But it's so true. And I find that it's typically, and again, I keep going back to this, and I've just seen it so much lately, and I find that it's typically men that say, well, actually, that's not as important.
Yeah.
Gender is not really an issue, right. And the only reason you think it is an issue is because you're a woman.
Yeah.
Literally.
And that's why we have to have more men who bring the issue up. Sometimes the men who do, I've noticed, are things, want to be seen as great heroes. Sometimes it's a way of getting the girl. It almost becomes a line with some men, but it needs to be more collectively done. I think in some groups, there are real struggles for this, but they should all be an issue. I don't think there's anything wrong, for instance, having an all white group, or an all black group or Latino group. It's going to have. I mean, no one would think there's anything wrong with having an all-Latino or black group, but an all-white group, people feel very self-conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we all white? But I think it's important to discuss that. Why are we all white? Do we want to then build alliances, or do we want to see if we can't bring people in? Does this mean I really don't have very many friends of color, it looks like, because I would want them to be here and to reflect upon that. And it doesn't mean you change it, but just to be or feel guilty about it, but just to be constantly aware of it and bring it out. We're an all white group, and this says something about this society. But we're doing, doing what we can, and we think it's important to be not pretend that isn't the case and that we're uncomfortable about it.
Do you find that many of those groups eventually end up disbanding because of so much of that self kind of nitpick, just examination and cross-examination constantly?
No, I think the ones that don't deal with it tend to fall apart more, or get kind of flaky. I think it's the big weakness in the anarchist kind of punk movement, both it being pretty male dominated, but white and pretty youth dominated. And I know, like the anarchist book fair, you can see that other people, they're all ages there.
Right.
There are people with kids, there are people of color.
There are people who aren't wearing black.
Yeah, exactly. And there are people who are, and but in most of these, in the groups, on a day-to-day basis, I think it's a big problem that leads to, I think the consciousness of it is not to get into the guilt and all, but to say, let's study. I know a group now, Bring the Ruckus, which is some of the people who left Love and Rage, when Love and Rage fell apart in 1997,
right.
98. Some of the people have started this group, and they're being very careful looking at what happened to Love and Rage, and one is, the racial and class issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think women should be more of an issue because they were pretty male-dominated. But it was a wonderful organization, and their newspaper. I don't know if you were too young to be paying attention to it, but it was a wonderful.
I know. We have at our house. We have like a little library, and one of the popular books that people always look at is there's like a compilation of essays from people that were a part of Love and Rage, and it is surprising to me how it's only women that ever address the gender issue.
Yeah. This is a big problem. I'm on their listserv now, and I've gotten to know a couple of people really well, and It's really only, I mean, there are a number of women involved, but there's only one woman, Tracy, who really writes about the women's issue. And they're very conscious also of the race, you know, issue. But what they are trying to do, they're saying, you know, they haven't really made it an organization yet. They're trying to develop very carefully the basis of it. Is that they're studying, they're having study groups and studying material on, you know, reparations, on women's issues, and they have list of readings and a lot of this. They're in just two or three places right now. I don't think they're, but they just went on a reading. And I think that that's really a good way of doing it. If you aren't linked up with minority communities and you can't see any opportunity to do so, the least you can do is read, you know, read their materials, see what kind of, how you could, I mean, anyone can incorporate the reparations issue, for instance.
Right.
Because this belongs to everyone. This is an obligation to people who were enslaved, the wealth of this country. I don't care if you're an immigrant 2 years ago or Schwarzenegger or whatever. And you had nothing to do with that. Your family didn't own slaves. My family certainly didn't own slaves. But nevertheless, we all live in this hugely wealthy country, and we all derive some benefits from it. And we're all responsible for that history, I think, if we live here.
Absolutely.
And the same for the Indian.
Even to talk about it, you know, to make our children aware of it, so that their textbooks are not like, you know, Columbus came and split a corn cob with the Indians and they had Thanksgiving dinner and it was great.
Yeah, and to act upon it, you know, to raise consciousness. Mm-hmm. Same with Indian sovereignty and land. I hear people tossing around that the California Indian tribes are special interests, you know, without seemingly a drop of consciousness. You know, this all used to be the Indian land, you know, before it was taken. And, you know, that
manifest destiny.
That they're saying, oh, God, they have all that money now, you know, the Indian tribes. I mean, it's really shocking how little consciousness there is. And even on, you know, even among activists sometimes, there's just, I think people learn how to be very politically correct and often just not to say anything at all.
Right.
Not to say, they think if they say Native American instead of Indian, that means they, you know, aren't doing something wrong. And actually Indian is fine to say. Right. It's not even. And with African Americans, they, you have to go, you know, study that history, dig out the stuff on your own, go to the websites, you know, the Trans-Africa websites, and build, you know, if you do that, if you really start doing that and inquiring, asking for materials, you will find you'll build alliances. You'll find, you know, that there will be cooperative work, but you can't just wait for someone to come and recruit you to it and sit down and train you in it. Or let's say men, for women to come and, you know, tutor them in. I mean, they can do the research. They can read The Second Sex.
That's right.
They can read the Red Stockings materials. They can they can read Dialectic of Sex. All those books are available.
Pedagogy of
On the history of women. Right. I mean, there are hundreds of books. And I honestly don't know many men who've, other than Chris Crass, my buddy Chris Crass, who actually majored in women's studies
at
San Francisco State so he could learn. And he's read everything. He knows that literature so well. So it can be done. I mean, you know, men can acquire a knowledge and not worry so much about their...
To so many men, it's like it's so inconsequential in terms of the larger picture of a quote revolution, you know. And you mentioned earlier that now you've seen the women take like these fundraising roles or organizing benefits or something, and the men are typically the ones getting up and, you know, shouting and rallying people and stuff. And what I find so interesting about that is whenever I hear these people, I'm always like, you know, number one, I feel like you're very uninformed about what you're talking about. And number two, it doesn't seem like there's really a plan. It seems like all this is coming out and it's a lot of hot air, but there's no there's no direction. And so all these people rally behind you, and then they look, and you're in the back lines. You know, you've left the front lines because you don't know where to lead people.
Yeah, and often if someone says, okay, that sounds like a good idea, let's have volunteers to do this and that. It's mostly the women who hold up their hands to volunteer to do the phoning or the research or whatever. And I think what should be said when someone comes up with a bright idea is said, okay, why don't you organize that?
Mm-hmm.
Get a team together and put it into effect, you know, instead of just telling what everyone else should do. You know, I hear a lot of it these days, you know, and I guess it's not new, but it seems like it's coming my way. Maybe I'm on the internet too much, but people saying, you know, the left should do this, the left should, they should blame themselves for not doing this and not doing that. Who are you talking about, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, what have you been doing?
posting stuff online, you know, like in this flame war, like on a thread.
Do it, you know, if it's not being done, then get a group together and do it, you know, and this blame. Yeah, I think this is part of what I was talking about of not taking responsibility and wanting to be the... I mean, a lot of rewards accrue to people who get in leadership positions in this society. Now, I take again the... you know, my ex-husband is an Acoma Pueblo Indian, and I'm still very close to that family. And I've seen, like right now, my brother-in-law is tribal... chairman. I mean, he's on the tribal council. He was selected as chairman. And this is done, it's not an election. They do it in the traditional way in the Kiva in December and through ceremonies that are always completely secret. And a person cannot refuse. And during the year they serve, it's usually only 1 year at a time. Sometimes they're selected over and over. I think he's his third year on the tribal council. They have to put that first. You know, they can't do anything else. They don't get rewarded. They have to be dependent on the people. You know, they don't get rewarded at all. They get criticized all the time. You know, they get... And I think that that's the responsibility they have, you know, and it's not something anyone seeks out. You know, no one runs for it. No one wants to do it, but everyone's expected to serve at some time, and it's a sacrifice.
So is that, you know, is this like responsibility and accountability versus leadership, you know, as opposed to leadership?
And some of these people become very revered because they're beautiful. I mean, it brings out the best in people, actually. But they don't get special privileges for it, and their whole goal in life is to be able to die as someone who is respected among the people. Just respect, you know. And the only way to gain that is by, you know, that kind of collectivity and commitment, not by being a, you know, a notorious or being on the nightly news or Fox.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
That's not something I would recommend to anyone.
Being a bodybuilder, I don't know. And I mean, really, I think it's, you know, we are always commenting on people like Arnold, you know, Schwarzenegger and Bush and all, you know, men that, you know, are so stereotypical of everything that we despise about our society and, you know, our culture. And that's why I think it's so difficult. And then there's like this question hanging in the air of whether it is okay to criticize bad behavior, you know, and those same qualities within men, you know, and women. But I mean, this is a women's show. We're going to go ahead and say that, you know, we do believe that, you know, men from our experiences are very primarily people that, you know, tend to take over things and are very slow to, you know, admit when they're wrong and to just get over it and deal with it and move on. And like you said, to take accountability. So, I mean, I think it's something that, like, especially within this community, people struggle with all the time. Like, you know, should I really be worrying about this? Aren't there bigger things to worry, you know, like, shouldn't I be fighting, you know, these outside forces like the government and, you know, shouldn't I just get over it?
Yeah, well, we have to ask, you know, where does all this start? You know, authoritarianism and domination is basically all of it is structured on the male supremacy. You know, this was, I believe, historically the first, and like I said, probably for reasons, if you look at it, not that people thought out, but that this was the, well, it's my idea, you know, men, not just mine, but Maria Mize and quite a few feminist theorists, that the hunting, the division of labor of men hunting, and of course, while men were hunting, women were gradually creating agriculture and horticulture. Mm-hmm. And plants, you know, taming plants or picking wild plants, sometimes not taming them, but gathering them and processing them into food and clothing and so forth. And these are collective activities. They're activities that build community and a different kind of leadership. When men and hunting, sometimes 8-9 months a year, this is very individualistic. In most societies, there's not a an absolute necessity for it after agriculture is created. So what men transfer that to is, or not as much of it as needed, or they start growing their own, you know, domesticated animals or whatever. That weapon of death is then, you know, this is, it just so easily morphs into war. Mm-hmm. And taking other people's possessions, encroaching on other neighborhoods, and in fact taking over communities, suppressing
women.
Isn't
that women. Fear, though? I mean, isn't that... Do you ever
well,
get the
I
sense
that... Well, I think it's power.
It,
you know, I think it's a power that got... It's an aggressive... and maybe at one time a necessary power when, God knows, you know, the whole earth was almost covered with ice. And that was really harsh times. And I think that these things go so far back where now, like I say, we've only 1% of our time in... as human beings developing agriculture... It's such a small part of our existence that we're really going to have to work at transforming our world into something that has a future and isn't going to destroy us all. You know, I mean, we need to figure out how to get off this planet if it's if our sun is going to disappear. We need to figure out a lot of things if we want to persist. And I think
let's get together a committee and we're
going. And I think we need to persist. I mean, I think human beings have really great potential. Who knows? We may be the only creatures like this in the whole universe, and it's who are speculative and interested, and how
we are definitely speculative.
Yeah, and how then do we get rid of misusing this power? You know, for individuals, we've got the worst system possible now: capitalism and greed for the last 500 years, building up and conquest of other people and stealing their resources, and you know, putting them in subjugation. This is the worst possible scenario. How, and we've had lots of workable ideas. It's not that they haven't worked. We haven't made them work. We haven't figured out how to make them work. But I think the ideas are probably all there between feminism and Marxism and psychoanalysis and anti-racism, understanding, you know, what the problems are. How can we better use resources on the earth, restore some of the balance. It's really, you know, when you think of like 95% of the human species that exist, the animals and plant species that existed 500 years ago now do not exist.
Right.
That's really terrifying.
No, it's very true. I've,
Well, and with that, we are going to take a short musical break and let Roxanne get some water. And we'll be right back. You are listening to The Radical Tea Party here on Enemy Combatant Radio every Wednesday from 4 to 6 p.m. And today in the studio, we've been talking with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. And we'll be back in a second, and we're going to, you know, continue this discussion about feminism and activism and radicalism and all those other words that you hear all the time, but you're always, you know, you never really get to extrapolate on them. We'll be back in a second. This is Lucinda Williams.
I'm going to buy you a fan.
Oh, is it like that?
Get down with it. Mm-hmm.
I would risk the serpent's bite. I would dance around with seven. I would kiss the diamond back if I knew it would get me to heaven. 'Cause I wanna get right with God. Yes, you know you got to get right with God. I would burn souls over. If I give up.